Kevin, I'm with Scott Eubank in San Jose, California, and we start off with our traditional question, which is, what were you born?
I was born at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, but that's near Oakland, California, but my family was living in, and I grew up in Sunnyvale, which is 9 miles north of San Jose, where we are now.
Mm-hmm. And what was your parents' occupations when you were born?
My mother wasn't working. My father was personnel administrator at Libby McNeil and Libby's Cannery in Sunnyvale, where he had been for 2 years after being wounded out of the Second World War.
And did they have any college education?
Both of them attended Oklahoma State University. My father graduated. My mother still has a unit or two to go.
Mm-hmm. And you went to high school in that same area?
Sunnyvale High School.
Sunnyvale High School. What year did you graduate high school?
1965.
And did you ever have any inkling before you went to college that you would do any kind of international work? Any kind of motivation?
I knew I would travel internationally, but nothing more than that.
Just a gut instinct?
Sure.
Okay. Where did you go to college?
Stanford. I was an undergrad at Stanford.
Stanford. What was your major?
Political science.
Because?
Political science and history interested me more than other subjects.
Okay. And was there an area in political science you were especially interested in?
I was drawn almost immediately to Asia, but that's probably, as I've later figured it, because here we are on the left coast, here we are in the Pacific, and there's just no other place to go to keep looking except westward to mm-hmm. Asia. Mm-hmm. And so many of my friends were of Chinese, Japanese descent, and had outlooks that reached beyond the Pacific, that it was natural. Even my parents recognized it. And they were both from Oklahoma, where you wouldn't automatically expect them to develop that kind of outlook.
Well, speaking of outlooks, did your family have any religious orientation when you were growing up?
Baptist, yes.
And how did you first hear about IBS?
I was at Stanford, and volunteers in Asia had a program with IVS. Other volunteers in IVS participated in it, in fact, notably Chris Jenkins. And I...
Here, 1 second.
Yeah.
Back we go. And...
I heard about IVS. Yes. From that, and I also read Don Luce's book. I was, of course, very interested in what was happening in Vietnam. I was taking courses from people who had written books on Vietnam.
Oh, who would that be?
John Lewis, America and Vietnam. Mm-hmm. John Wilson Lewis. Michael Oxenberg ended up as my advisor. Both the political tenor, what people were interested in historically and politically at Stanford made Vietnam very interesting. Mm-hmm.
And do you think that had an influence in you signing up for?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It increased my interest.
Mm-hmm. And how did you, there were volunteers in Asia who came to the campus.
Yeah.
How did that connect up with IVS? With you?
Well, IVS came as well to interview and talk to people who were interested in IVS. Mm-hmm. I interviewed, applied. I also applied to the Peace Corps and ended up with an assignment in the Peace Corps. And let's see. Where was I? I can't remember anymore except that I would have been trained in the language and then worked in diesel agricultural mechanics.
And you chose the IVS assignment instead.
Yeah, IVS is where the action was.
Uh-huh. Because you'd go to Vietnam.
That's right.
We were going as a community development worker? Or,
that's right.
So you started off with you went to Harper's Ferry?
That's right.
Do you remember any speeches or pep talks or things?
Oh, sure, I can remember them. I'm not sure if I can identify Yeah. I remember John Llewellyn, mm-hmm. Who had just returned from Vietnam. I remember the director of IVS. I remember the other volunteers. Mm-hmm. I think Dick Peters was there. Mm-hmm. It was a good group, an impressive group.
Mm-hmm. What did John, do you remember anything that John said in his presentation?
Oh, he was very down to earth.
Yes.
As I recollect, and he was making no excuses for what it was like in Vietnam. But it was clear that the experience had been meaningful to him, mm-hmm. and he wanted it to be meaningful for the rest of us as well. He wasn't a cheerleader. Mm-hmm. I can't remember anything that he offered specifically as advice, but you got the feeling that he had worked his way through it, that he'd done a good job, and it was well worth imitating him.
Well, the reason I ask is John was with the RADA, wasn't he? He was in Martin Yard
yes.
District.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. right.
Because, talking to him, it sounded like when he left, he was almost out of his mind. So he really
I could
did a
see
lot
that.
Of maintaining.
He could have been very intense.
Yes. No, I don't mean out of his mind insane. I just meant it was a very wrenching experience.
Oh, that's what I mean, too.
Yes, yes.
I think we were part of his decompression.
Mm-hmm. I know you were. I remember that discussion. Mm. All right. Was there any attempt to give you, were there any, did the State Department send anybody to talk to you?
They may have, yeah. but it would have been on a most respectable level. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think anybody in the group was adverse to hearing someone from the government mm-hmm. speak. In fact, we would have been eager for it. It wasn't as if we felt we were easily led or that the wool could be pulled over our eyes.
When you went, actually I'd like your own response, but also if you have any, what you felt the group's feeling was, but what we're trying to do is understand whether mm-hmm. any sea change took place in the values or views of IVSers as we go into the late 60s and early 70s, whether there were people who were very, I think as you, were very interested in what was going on over there, mm-hmm. wanted to know what was going on over there, and knew that without going there...
You've asked something that I've sort of yeah. posed to myself.
Okay.
Nothing I saw there changed my mind. Nothing.
So you came back pro-war then? Just
I did not.
You did not.
I had been an ROTC at Stanford and left uh-huh. it after 2 years, although, uh-huh. interestingly enough, the best instructors I had at Stanford, at least the ones to whom you could relate best, I'm sure were my ROTC instructors, mm-hmm. just because they had so much more breadth than the English and most of the history instructors mm-hmm. I encountered my first 2 years. They were not people who pushed you to any particular political or other position. They talked with you frankly about their experiences, their ambitions, what they expected when they went to serve in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and it was frighteningly adult. Mm-hmm. You didn't always find that in the rest of Stanford mm-hmm. academia or probably anywhere else, mm-hmm. but when I went to Vietnam, I was sure that the situation wasn't very good. It was not nearly as good as the press stated it, and I left with the same impression, but with a lot more facts. Mm-hmm. I was going to return to Vietnam. I came home after 2 years, mm-hmm. and I was going to return to Vietnam for another tour, but IVS was forced out of Vietnam mm-hmm. in the time I was home.
Mm-hmm. But did you get the feeling that the group that was going out there had, it's not so much made up their mind that the war was an unpleasant thing that the U.S. shouldn't be involved in?
No, I think it was diverse. There were people mm-hmm. who were who went from mildly to decidedly in support of the war, mm-hmm. To others who had great doubts to outright opposition.
Mm-hmm. So it remained a mixed group.
It was a mixed group.
And this was you would have left in '69.
Correct.
So it would be July 69?
That's right. We ended up in Vietnam second or third week of July. I remember that because we were still in the Philippines and watching the Apollo moon landing at a student union television set at the University of the Philippines College of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that, within 2 weeks, we were in Vietnam.
Yeah, a friend of mine was in Vietnam and wrote a poem about that.
Hmm.
About
the moon landing?
What the moon landing meant to guys in a rice paddy in Vietnam in August of 1969.
Yeah.
Just because we slightly there got ahead of ourselves, after Harper's Ferry, you went for the usual training at Los Baños.
Yeah, that was great fun.
International Rice
Institute. The people that IVS sent to train you, and who were your liaison and who were your instructors, were very good. Mm-hmm. I cannot remember the name of our instructor in, or the person who shepherded us through Los Baños, but he was the team leader in Laos. It was Jim something, and he was knowledgeable, cool, and lots of fun. Almost every evening we sat around eating roast peanuts and drinking San Miguel beer in those hot, hot evenings at, I think it was called Las Palmas. It was great fun. It was everything you could ask for at that age. Most everything.
Yes, most everything. And what was your first impression when you arrived in Vietnam, you arrived in Saigon?
It was real hot. The airport was real busy. Mm-hmm. I had no business wearing this suit, which I stored in Saigon, left with Hugh Mankey, who wore it to a number of embassy functions. Hugh will confirm that.
Yes. Hugh Mankey wore your suit.
Boy, I didn't.
And you spent a couple of days at the IVS house.
Yeah, more than that, maybe a week. Mm-hmm. And then I was assigned up country. Dan Whitfield was in charge.
That's the next question. Yeah.
And Dan told me where I was going and took me up there, as I recollect. Dan's command of Vietnamese is wonderful. Mm-hmm. He spoke superior North Vietnamese, better than most North Vietnamese, because it was an educated, a literate version of the language. And they sent me up to the highlands pretty much on my own. I hadn't expected that.
Well, the interesting thing is that it appears that you are essentially a third generation community development worker in the highlands.
I replaced, yes.
That same experience, though.
Stu Pettigrove was my immediate predecessor.
Okay.
If you can find Stu, you should talk with him. He came back here, he's from California originally, and he went to Davis. He was with the Methodist Church as a missionary, as an agricultural missionary for some time. I'm afraid, lost track of him.
I think I know where he is. I'll try to find
him. Gee, tell me.
No, I think someone mentioned him and said he was in Davis, but I could be wrong.
It was me when I talked with
him.
I know we discussed it. That was my last
contact
with him.
So that was an accurate reportage. I spoke to someone,
yeah.
They suggested he might be there. No, but someone else said there was someone else at UC Davis, other than Ray Borden, who's also there. That's what I mentioned.
And Paul Horton. Have you
run
into Paul Horton? Mm-hmm. Paul is from Davis originally. Mm-hmm. Paul was terribly hurt in Vietnam when a GI drove him off the road. Mm-hmm. And I had a tremendous life-threatening head injury and came back to the States. And I, on a third-party basis, kept an idea of where he was and how he was doing for a long time. But
you have not. Was he in California, though?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll ask Jim Colcini.
Paul worked nearly on his own at Vietnam's only mental hospital in Bien Hoa, and was responsible, to a large extent, for maintaining and keeping the physical plant going, as well as more developmental activities there too, with both the inmates and the staff. He wasn't just a technician, but it was a significantly important and lonely assignment.
Mm-hmm. By the way, there's a book out by a nurse. It's called American Daughter Gone to Vietnam. And she worked I should know the name of this from the top, off right off the top of my head, but it was a serious head injury ward.
At an American hospital?
I think it was in Long Bend or Ben.
Paul was in it. I visited him in
that kind of ward. Woman, by the way, those are the years. And it really had a tremendous...
May I take you to your room?
Not yet, sweetheart.
Right in the middle of
we're talking now.
Really thank you for that offer, especially in such a pretty dress.
Say goodnight,
Annie.
Thank you. Nightgown.
That's very nice. It's a very pretty nightgown.
You're supposed to spend the night with us.
Okay.
Night, Annie.
Night. And, so you arrived there, Dan Whitfield took you up there.
Yes.
And did he introduce you to anybody?
He introduced me to, there were other volunteers in town, mm-hmm. Bob Henderson, Rich Trinbath, and, John Worth. Mm-hmm. And I took over Stu Pettigrove's roommate, who was a Vietnamese Army lieutenant who became my Vietnamese instructor. Mm-hmm. He was North Vietnamese, and after 6 weeks assured me I'd never speak Vietnamese.
How reassuring.
Yeah, he was very demanding.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good. You want that in an instructor.
Mm.
And was there an existing project you were taking over from Stu?
Yes, there were some garden projects and some hints of interest in working on transporting what people produced in truck gardens to Saigon. It was very loose.
Cold weather vegetables?
Yes. It was, I won't say cold up there, but it was the kind of climate suited for growing what you might find here in Santa Cruz. You could even grow broccoli up there.
Oh, yeah.
At least higher than we were. In Dalat, you could.
Right, for the record.
And artichokes.
The place you were sent to was called?
Baolop. Baolok. Mm-hmm. It was the provincial capital of Lam Dong province, spelled L-A-M, then D-O-N-G.
And what was the nearest city in its location to?
Baolop was the capital. Right. It was 120, 150 miles north of Saigon, up the Annamite Cordillera, up the mountains, up Vietnamese National Road 20. Mm-hmm. And it was two-thirds of the way to the French hill town of Dalat, mm-hmm. which was also a major vegetable-growing region. Right. And a major center for tribesmen, for Montagnards, of the group I worked with.
Mm-hmm. And so the idea was to get Montagnard villagers to grow, just begin truck gardens.
Yes.
And to supplement their diet and perhaps earn cash.
Yes, both.
And this seemed to be, this seemed to you to be a good thing.
Oh, it did. Also, we tried to apply what we learned at the University of the Philippines College of Agriculture mm-hmm. and rice production, which, looking back, is pretty funny. A 21-year-old with a liberal arts education trying to teach Montagnard highland farmers how to grow rice has its comic moments. But the people actually did try the things, and they were especially impressed and enthused when we could provide some of the materials to do it. Although, I think, like most IVS people, I kept that to a minimum, a bare minimum. But I worked closely in that regard with the Montagnard Agricultural Training Center, run by a very capable man named Cassette, that's K-apostrophe-S-E-T, Tambu, T-A-M-B-O-U, one of the best, most capable men I've ever met.
And he worked for?
He worked for the government at the Montagnard Agricultural Training Center. He was from that area, and he would run essentially extension projects into the village, although it was very loose and he was on his own without support or a lot of help from other organizations. And with a little bit of IVS enthusiasm, a Jeep occasionally, some seedlings and an idea of where to go, we teamed up. And we're probably successful in some of the lowland rice projects we started, because what we were introducing was a high yield rice. But in the upland projects, that is rice planted on hillsides.
Dry rice, right?
Yes. Yeah. The local varieties were as good as anything that we could offer. But there was lowland rice up there, and the Montagnards did have it, mm-hmm. and that made them more likely to be self-sufficient and beyond mm-hmm. than people who farmed merely dry mm-hmm. or upland rice.
Well,
Vietnam was a rice exporter even during the war mm-hmm. for a long time, and the Montagnards were not dumb in the way they used rice. And what we could offer in terms of technique, they would look at, and I think with a kind of practiced eye, adopt what they thought was good and what might help them. These were not stupid people.
And did you ever divine the government's attitude towards Montagnards? That is the Saigon's idea?
Sure. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of persons who worked with the Montagnards, people who were Vietnamese, who were not only sympathetic, but tolerant and had an appreciation and understanding for the culture. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, the government officials didn't want the Montagnards to cause any trouble, didn't want the Viet Cong harbored there, and would provide them with resources after all of the other needs and interests had been met.
And what about, one would imagine that particular area very active in terms of the
of
the
fighting?
War?
Mm-hmm. It was one of the two or three provinces that was not heavily attacked during the Tet Offensive. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it because it was settled by Montagnards who were not particularly interested in the communists, and by North Vietnamese who'd been resettled there after 1954, mm-hmm. and had become relatively prosperous by growing rice and tea. There's a lot of tea up there, and coffee for that matter.
After a short break to put someone to bed, we resume, and we were talking about the agricultural products in the
North Vietnamese who resettled in 1954 did well for themselves. They were mainly Catholic. They coexisted with the benefit of President Diem's projects, which benefited them much more than anyone else in the highlands, with the tribesmen, and grew tea. Vietnam was self-sufficient in tea, just as it was in rice for a long time, and most of it came from this region. The tea wasn't as good as you would find in other countries in Asia, but it was certainly enough to supply Vietnam. The Montagnards also participated. They had cash crop tea and coffee. Because of French influence, when they had a choice of cash crops, would grow coffee as often, and more often actually, than tea. So as far as beverages went, they do very well in the highlands.
Were they, it's interesting because, this resettlement program of North Vietnamese
yes.
into Highlander areas, did that, we're kind of, what do you call it, on a kind of thin edge here. Do you think that in some ways benefited the Montagnards then, because of...
No, I don't think it benefited them. Because they weren't given preserves or reservations. They were subject to what the government wanted to do with refugees and with North Vietnamese who supported the regime. I won't go as far as calling them constant victims, but they were not likely and didn't, not likely to receive and didn't receive the benefits that the Vietnamese did from the government.
You know, thinking something we mentioned earlier, that this was a region of people who were relatively isolated from VC propaganda, or not necessarily...
Yeah, we were talking about that. And I think it's worth making this point. It was not a heavily contested area in the 1968 Tet Offensive. Mm-hmm. It was one of, I think, three provinces that wasn't overrun in the central or capital city of the province. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the Viet Cong, I concluded, were more likely to stage a very violent, bloody event to show the people, Montagnards and Vietnamese, that the government couldn't protect them, mm-hmm. that they were subject to terror and could not trust what the government promised economically and certainly militarily. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, what did take place was likely to be more violent than what you'd find in the lowlands, in the Mekong Delta, where there was a more symbiotic relationship between the Viet Cong guerrillas, mm-hmm. and the local population. In the province where I was stationed, there would be ambushes on the highways, or there would be minings, or there would be assassinations in villages, which were meant to be very pointed reminders of how ineffective the government control overall was. Also, there was a constant, at least in the first year I was there, mortaring of the capital city. You could actually stand on the second floor balcony where I lived and watch the mortars in the tea fields. That is, you could see the flashes as the bombs left the tubes. And flew their way into their targets. Those were all reminders that the government wasn't going to be able to protect the people. So this province had the advantage of daytime security, and for the most part being unlikely to succumb to Vietnamese propaganda, Viet Cong propaganda, but at the same time, the nighttime that in the Delta you would expect to be the time for the Viet Cong to work would be the same in the highlands. No one was out. There were curfews. It was dangerous.
Well, someone remarked, actually, now this should become really a standard question, which was Randy Iverson, mm-hmm. his interview, because he's done so much community development work. And so I asked him, I said, is it possible for CD activities to take place through an NGO, mm-hmm. During a time of civil conflict? And he said, and it was interesting because it was an instant and emphatic no. He said, you can have education, you can have medical services, there's a whole variety of things. But in the middle of a civil conflict, there's one thing you can't do, and that is, because no one knows what the outcome is going to be, they can't plan effectively or have faith in what's going to happen in the future. And so they can't make the kinds of decisions, the investments that lead to development.
Although you would find that people almost contrary to what was taking place around them would do that. Mm-hmm. They have to. you can't live simply as refugees, especially if you're not a refugee. The Moton Yards in particular tried to live and work as if the land where they settled belonged to them, and as if they had a future. And I'm sure the Vietnamese did the same thing. So I think maybe theoretically Randy might be right, but at the Patty level, people did live that way and were interested in adopting techniques and doing things that would make them more prosperous, able to care for their families, and progress. It was an interesting insight to see people under so much stress, with so many problems, try to act as if there was a future, and as if they should maintain, but increase their ability to produce from the land. The people I worked with had more moxie, more courage, and more ability to face hard decisions than any people I'll ever meet.
Why do you think they have that?
Sure. They had a constant interest in making their lives better, despite the adversity. And maybe they had trained themselves, because they'd had conflicts with the Vietnamese for so long, to expect or not to think it was unusual to face terrific adversity.
Because of something that someone else said in an interview, this is another question I think we need to ask more often. You read Unheard Voices.
That was influential for, to me.
Don Luce and John Summers' book about the Vietnam at war. And when I was interviewed in IBSer, who had later joined USAID, and he said, all those stories were just, you know, rumor that bunch of young people tell each other, and it circulates around, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you know, it's not really true.
No, that's nonsense.
Yes, well, had you read the book, and then you saw the movie, so to speak, and you went out into the field, what was your, would be your...
Well, much more what Don and John said than the AID comments.
Did you have any experiences of similar experiences along those lines?
Well, tell me what you think was a typical experience.
Well, I don't, unfortunately.
That Don and John reported.
Let's take the U.S. in. See, the
I wasn't,
military wasn't.
Where I was, I wasn't highly politicized. Well, right. Actually, the first 6 months I was in Baolup, an element of the 173rd Airborne Brigade, and a battalion, in fact, was right outside town. And they drew fire, they drew sappers, they staged missions which caused firefights and small but sometimes pitch battles all the time. I won't say that the mountainous region where I was highly and constantly contested. It was more of a place where elements pass through. But as long as there was a strong American or Arvin presence seeking out and trying to neutralize the Viet Cong, there was a lot of fighting and a lot of nighttime activity. There was American influence on the town for a while, which was an open city. I can still remember taking one GI that was in my first 6 months there, who was so strung out on heroin he couldn't walk, into my jeep and back to the battalion perimeter, where where the guards took him in.
So in town you'd have wandering,
yeah,
heroin addicted GIs.
Yeah, and but after a while the commanders stopped the unlimited access to the town, and then after 6 months the battalion left the area. Mm-hmm. But it was really Indian country when they were there. Mm-hmm. There were lots of attempts to get inside, and there were flares, firefights, and occasionally helicopter gunships and spooky runs. Mm-hmm. The spooky runs were mainly out in the mountains against other targets, but there was a lot going on as they tried to penetrate and cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
And was there a visible effect on the town while they were there and then when they withdrew?
Yeah, I think so. It was rowdier. It was more like Dodge City. It was never what I saw and experienced in Nha Trang, Saigon, Nha Tui Hoa, any of the other areas where there were larger concentrations of troops.
And did the people that you worked with ever get in the way of some of these military operations?
It was hard to avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
They were more likely to be militia who at night would draw duty, or there are even some soldiers there. The Arvin 23rd Division was stationed up there, and some of the people were from the villages were part of that division and lived and essentially served in the same region. There were numbers of violent acts. I was out of the town once when there was a concerted Viet Cong raid into town, in which, as somebody told me, uncharacteristically, the guard at the Vietnamese military compound was awake and sounded the alarm, and there was a terrific firefight downtown which left several Viet Cong dead. An attack that didn't succeed. I think for the most part the Viet Cong were content with making the people keep their heads down. They used the level of force and what they thought they could expend to remind and show the people that the government couldn't protect them.
Mm-hmm. Did it work? I mean, were the people convinced the government couldn't protect them?
I don't think the Montagnards ever thought the government wanted to protect them. The people in the towns, I think for a while, towards the end of the time I was there, felt better protected. But that was also when a lot of Vietnamese from Cambodia were being resettled there too, and there was a different emphasis.
In what sense?
A lot of the government activities were going towards helping these people, these true refugees,
mm-hmm.
Who were not by any shakes going to be united with the Viet Cong. I think people were cautious, certainly anti-communist. Unwilling to go from village to village or village to town at night.
This is a pretty hardcore. I mean, the North Vietnamese that are resettled certainly aren't counting on a Viet Cong victory or
no, they
even
weren't.
Thinking about it because.
But they are also very interested in family, and they weren't clearing areas permanently. I think that was something you found throughout Vietnam. I'm convinced that with a more vigorous military presence, they could have cleared the province, at least as far as the mountainous regions where the NVA and the main force units were moving supplies down. Mm-hmm. But that kind of vigor wasn't there.
Why?
Oh, for all the reasons. It wasn't anywhere else in Vietnam. People wanted to live on their own. They didn't trust the government. They weren't trained effectively. The Viet Cong did a fair job of reminding them that they could strike when they wanted. But it was probably better in that province than most others, mm-hmm. at least many others.
Well, one of the interesting things is that people contrast, well, the story is that John Paul Vann was at some place in the South where, and he was very, we talk about this all the time about it, yes, a lot of people knew John Paul Vann.
Yes, they did.
We talked to them. And he was explaining, he took David Halberstam out to a battle, which the South Vietnamese lost very badly.
Yes.
And he said, you know, Halberstam was saying, oh, well.
Which one was this?
Oh, it wasn't Op Bok or anything.
It wasn't Op Bok, yeah.
Operation.
Yeah.
And he said, now look, these guys held their ground against incredible odds.
Yes.
Prepared a line of retreat if they needed it, but they didn't use it.
Yes.
They inflicted enormous casualties, and they took their own people with them when they left to at least deny the enemy any psychological victory. And he said, and do you know why I'm telling you this? He says, why? Because the people they defeated were their brothers.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why the South Vietnamese Army should not be up to that standard, because they're the same people.
Yeah.
And so the question really is, how come those people could hang around night after night inflicting this physical, you know, this lack of security,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. But
very good question.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm going to guess it was because the government, the central government, was letting them down. It just wasn't as organized and as effective as the government of North Vietnam. I mean, look at the folks. So yeah, you had Tiu and Diem and all these people fighting among themselves. And the people in the provinces knew this. They knew that this wasn't a government that ultimately was going to gallop to their aid. It wasn't a government that was going to place itself in jeopardy for some provincial capital. They weren't as tough.
Yeah, I love that phrase. They wouldn't gallop to their aid. There was there have been similar remarks. The idea that one USAID, ex-IVS,
mm-hmm.
said that the real difference was that there was always something more important than winning the war.
Yeah, that's a good comment.
Somewhere along the line there, for the one side, and actually Harry Summers has even said that.
Yeah.
That the point was that the North was fighting this war not just to win, it was, and well, yes, just to win, but my point was, no, that was the whole ethos of the movement, was to reunite the country. And so they knew exactly what they were doing. Whereas the South never had the luxury of being able to fight for reuniting the country, since that wasn't going to happen. The South wasn't going to reunite.
Should they have invaded the North?
Well, that's what Key said. Supposedly Key one day said,
yeah,
let's march north. And some general said, you can't even march out of your compound.
Yeah.
You know, but he had a point. That is, if they had such an ethos. But the question is whether they could make that ethos felt. And there was no reason why they had the apparatus that the North had, for example,
right,
which could make people. That's, by the way, something very nice in Bao Nguyen's book, in the Tsar of War, where he's a school kid, and every kid in that school doesn't just want to fight for their country, but they're all almost looking forward.
Whose book?
Bao Nguyen's book.
Yes.
That they're it's just a matter of course that they're going to go and fight as long as it takes, whereas in the South they didn't even draft 18-year-olds until 1968. So.
Yeah. Did you read Where the Ashes Are?
Hmm. No, I've heard of this, though. This is great, thank you.
It's a very good book.
Uh-huh. Great. I have a question to ask, which is, you mentioned something that you were aware that John Paul Vann, you know, had an interest in.
In what?
Or IVS, or you said, oh, yes.
He was certainly an admirable guy. I knew people who knew him.
Uh-huh.
Of course, after reading Neil Sheehan's book, I think I gained some insight into what was going on at levels I could never see or achieve.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting character.
And
Dr. Jerry Hickey thinks that Sheehan did a great disservice by writing that book.
Why?
He doesn't agree with what Sheehan said about Van's effect, and he thinks ultimately that the United States could have and should have won the war. It would have been much like winning the war in Korea. It would have been a Syngman Rhee, but eventually there would have been a much more democratic and prosperous country, mm-hmm. and the North would have become like North Korea.
Yes, well, the sad thing was we never had the same commitment.
No.
No, from the day one, it was made very clear that the United States did not have the same commitment to the...
We got in real, real late, too.
Yeah.
With South Korea, there was an invasion. In Vietnam, there was an erosion, and we tried to conquer it or overcome that erosion by the same methods that we used in Korea. Ultimately, yeah.
Yes.
The South Vietnamese weren't up to it.
Well, there's obviously that's where the tragedy.
Although the South Vietnamese are probably going to win the country, mm-hmm. because they're so much more sophisticated. I think the North Vietnamese are more corrupt now, and the economic power lies in the South.
Mm-hmm. But Gandhi was asked, but wouldn't you have been better off, being ruled by the British? Wouldn't that be better? Mm-hmm. They're more efficient. They're not corrupt. This could easily happen if Indians win. And he said people would always rather be ruled badly by themselves than ruled efficiently by somebody else. And I always like to apply that to Vietnam by saying that if the Southern Vietnamese become the leaders of the country because of their economic strength, they will, then that will be the history of Vietnam determined by Vietnamese.
Yes.
Not by somebody else.
That's right.
And that's generally why people die. That is, they fight for those things. And it's ironic, of course, that this war happened maybe because, as the old argument, if only Ho had been allowed to, I'm
sure
of that. But the argument is, why not let history take its course? And the answer is because of arrogance of power, the threat of communism. It just wasn't going to happen. But there also wasn't going to be a commitment to preserve the country the way we had with Korea. George Ball said that in a memo in 65, and everyone nodded that. There was no question about it. Wasn't the same.
It wasn't the same.
So when people say, gee, if only we'd done that, say, well, yes, but we were never going to do that. And that's where we have to focus on then.
That's right.
At that level. And that always reminds me of what Johnson faced, which was he didn't want to, one of the reasons why he didn't have a declaration of war against North Korea and North Vietnam was that he was afraid that the American people might get really riled up in support of the war. And then if they didn't win it, they would be forced to use extreme measures, which would lead to wider war, which Vietnam, quote, wasn't worth. And that's why we didn't make that commitment. So I love the tragic aspects, at least are consistent. If you clear away the stuff, you can see why these things happened. And some of my students ask, well, why did we do that? You can say, well, this is why. It's not because of some secret conspiracy by a Masonic, or Satan or something like that.
That's right.
Just human beings at work. Well, that was the subject we were talking about.
Sure, it was.
Usually comes up somewhere along the line. But after your first 2 years there, how did you feel about the project in IVS and what you were doing?
Well, I thought we were actually doing something worthwhile, certainly worthwhile of going to return. You've got to remember, in 1971, when I was home on leave, if the tide hadn't turned, at least it was not unfavorable. It was in the midst of Vietnamization, there were large quantities of American weaponry flowing in, troops flowing out, but the Vietnamese, the ARVN, were holding their own probably they reached their zenith 1972 with their invasion into Laos, Lam Son 719. And it never got any better than that.
But
up
really
in the highlands.
The offensive was a total.
It was a disaster.
Yeah. But what about after the 72 Easter offensive?
Here I was home looking at it, reading it in the newspapers, and I was in school then. So it didn't have as much relevance.
Mm. But you felt after 2 years that things were going...
Yeah, with the projects I was doing, mm-hmm. Yes. There was probably greater security in the highlands than there had been. There was greater pressure on the Moulton Yards, too, so there was, if not an urgency, at least a kind of commitment to working with them that was... clear in my mind. The new refugees who were being brought and placed in the highlands were going to be settled on land that the Moulton Yards believed was theirs or would be theirs as they moved their fields from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me more important than ever to make sure that the people had the knowledge of the techniques that they could use to produce from their land and that they actually used those techniques as a way of showing the Vietnamese that they were cultivating and that this land was not simply there for the taking.
Well, let me just to clarify
and
that.
The people have responded as well.
Okay. Well, this is touching on a very interesting subject. So let me help you clarify that for,
mm-hmm.
for the record. Moulton Yards practice Swidden agriculture.
Well, up where I, Moulton Yards have always practiced
they
two
do,
kinds.
Think,
they
yes.
do both paddy land
exactly.
and upland dry rice farming.
And you were trying to encourage them?
Effective ways to do both. Where there was paddy land available, we try to introduce better methods and maybe even some better varieties of rice. Mm-hmm. Although. Just using their own varieties of rice in a more sophisticated way could increase their yield. And then we wanted them to sell that so they could buy things, including more land,
mm-hmm.
And hold title to it in ways the Vietnamese recognized it to secure themselves in their villages.
Mm.
They were no longer able to move from village to village, from field to field.
Mm-hmm.
And as Jerry Hickey so adamantly says in what he's written, their system of agriculture was not a way of wasting land. It was a slash and burn economy,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't a way of wasting the land or deforesting it. There was a natural cycle that they participated in, and what they did was not going to increase erosion or the other things that Westerners and the Vietnamese accused them of doing.
Okay.
But they were more or less static when I was there, and helping them to increase their ability to use the land was important.
Now that's a very interesting because the charges can be made as, for example, you're teaching them to get into a commercial economy. Next thing you know, they'll be buying potato chips and
mm-hmm.
Destroying their nutrition.
Well, they didn't have any choice except to get into the economy.
Right.
Because they had to coexist.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnamese were there.
Right.
And not to make use of what resources they had would have been backward. It would have been just regressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that most of them who had any kind of education, and the Moulton Yards were attending schools and learning things,
mm-hmm.
Wanted to be more progressive. They were open to looking at agricultural techniques and other ways to help themselves.
Mm-hmm. Did they ever get into things like fertilizer and insecticides?
Sure, yes. Although, you didn't want to emphasize that as a panacea, because this month's market might provide it and next month's might not. Mm-hmm. But they understood the need and the value of those kinds of enhancements.
Because mm-hmm. you mentioned technology.
Yeah.
Is that some
but mainly, it was using effective use of water buffalo planting techniques, better varieties, storing grain and when to plant. Very, very basic kinds of things, but still things that the International Rice Institute and other research organizations showed could make a significant difference mm-hmm. and increase in what they produced.
Mm-hmm. That's well put, because the issue is balanced development.
Well, they wanted it, and that was one good thing. They didn't want to remain static, because these are not stupid people. They knew that they would be left behind, and that the more that the Vietnamese who adopted these methods would outproduce them, and they would be subject to losing their land and their ability to coexist at near equality.
How have they done since then?
Not well. Interestingly enough, I don't think that the North Vietnamese policies are any worse than the Saigon policies, uninfluenced by outside American policies, have taken them. I essentially think, as I wrote in my master's, mm-hmm. that the Vietnamese policies are consistent no matter who is producing them. Mm-hmm. And it is to settle more Vietnamese, to exploit the highlands, to settle more Vietnamese in the highlands, to exploit the natural resources of the highlands, and to make the Moton Yards more like Vietnamese. And there are a million Moton Yards. In South Vietnam, there were 17 million people, and then a million Moton Yards on top of that. They were not an insignificant number.
Has their birth rate kept up? Because now the population is about 74 million.
Yeah, total. United Vietnam. I think it has, but I don't have any real good figures on that.
Mm-hmm. Have you read Terry Randall's book, Problems of Development in Island Vietnam?
Yes, I have.
Well, what did you think of it?
He's right, there are a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah. He usually is. I'm impressed because of the East West Center, of course, they've got all those publications, so I started reading some of them. When your 2 years came to an end, you thought you were just going to go home for a little bit?
I came home for leave. Mm-hmm. I had a physical, and the doctor told me I had a case of hepatitis. Mm-hmm. So I had to stick around an extra month, and in that month, IVS was kicked out of Vietnam, so I couldn't go back.
Well, why do you think they were kicked out of Vietnam? What's your take on the end of IVS?
Well, when I left, I knew that Hugh Mackey and Mark Lynch and others were negotiating very successfully with the Ministry of Agriculture and the Ministry of Ethnic Affairs, even the Ministry of even the Prime Minister's office, as I recollect, was interested and willing to keep IVS in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But the decision came down from American sources that IVS was no longer welcome. I mean, you can see why, superficially at least.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Too many IVS people or ex-IVS people were taking American reporters to see the bad and unfortunate things that were taking place. You take Alex Shimkin and Ron Moreau, mm-hmm. taking folks to the Delta near Châu Đốc Tainan province to and telling New York Times reporters about how the local Vietnamese army commanders were making peasants clear the minefields at the cost of people being blown up. And then, of course, you had Don Luce, who was a constant reminder of opposition. There was enough to make the American mission feel that it was time to get rid of IVS. I think the ultimate decision came from the Americans, not the Vietnamese, because in spite of all that had happened, in spite of all the conflicts IVS people had with the Vietnamese government, the government, I'm convinced, was not only willing but wanted us to stay there. And the excellent negotiating that Hugh, Dick Peters, and others did was overridden by what the American mission wanted.
Well,
I think around here I still have the little New York Times article that came out about the cancellation of IVS contract in Vietnam.
Well, I think, actually, I don't know if Richard had it, but even the article that Mark wrote actually was quite, I mean, it wasn't...
Do you mean Mark Lynch?
Mark Lynch, yes. It was not antagonistic.
What article did he write?
There was a little piece that actually did... I think...
In what publication?
Oh, I don't know. That's the thing I'm trying to remember, whether Richard Peters showed it to me. I'll have to... That's something I'll have to follow up.
I'll bet Mark's got a copy. Call him.
Well, that's the thing. He didn't return his form. Well, maybe
you know where he is. Go sit in his law office.
No. Is he in San Francisco or Washington?
D.C.
Yeah, right. I do have his law firm address. So.
Arnold and Porter.
Yeah, I'll make another note of it just to remember. I'll be there for the AAS meetings, so that's a good opportunity to do that. When the program closed down, you were in the United States.
I was.
I realize because of the area you worked in, this question almost has no significance, but were you able to keep in touch with people that you'd worked with in Vietnam, Vietnamese?
No, I didn't. That's probably my fault for not writing. Mm-hmm. Although, when I did my master's, mm-hmm. I interviewed people who had come to North Carolina. Mm-hmm. As you might recall, there was an effort to free 200 to 300 Montagnards who had fought against the communist government in 1975 and then had retreated into Cambodia, where they were essentially surrounded and, while not imprisoned, at least immobilized in the Dong Krek area of Cambodia, which is where the three borders of Laos, Cambodia,